welcome everybody to another episode of Church Hurts and the good, the bad, and the ugly about church, religion, and spirituality today, with a dash of recovery thrown in along the way. If you've ever had questions about the church, maybe you're feeling a bit jaded in your attitudes towards religion, and you've come to the right place. Because we've got a man, a host, who was an honors philosophy student, an ordained Presbyterian minister, and along the way planted and grew three churches, taught at a prestigious university, and preached at a megachurch. Now, well, he's just a self-proclaimed angry curmudgeon who never quits asking the question, why? Why not the host of Church Hurts and Dr. John Bash? Hey, Doctor.
You know, Paul, in my lifetime, few things have defined churches more than their music style selection. I've seen choosing a church go from denominational loyalty, Catholic, we've always been Baptist, Presbyterian, to my church has the best worship, this amazing band, this really powerful service, or we still sing the old hymns, have the same liturgy we've always had. Now, in that transition, a lot of people were hurt, felt betrayed, were angry, disappointed, confused. Also in that church, a lot of people gave up on church, leaving us at the lowest point of church attendance in our country's history. Church hurts. You bet it does. Music hurts. In church, it does. Can we learn something about this? What can it teach us about churches, about ourselves, and maybe something about God? I don't know anyone more qualified to help us navigate these waters than our guest that we have here today. His name is James Ward, and I don't have enough time to go through his list of albums, his degrees, his number of concerts this man has done, the children's music, the diversity of rock, and even his preferred jazz and blues. But I'll say this. James is the most thoughtful Christian musician I know who's walked through the times we now call the worship wars, and he's come out alive and filled with faith and a little bit wiser with his bumps and bruises, though. James, welcome to Church Hurts and.
Thanks so much, John. It's a pleasure to be with you from Tennessee, where I live.
Well, that's a good place for a musician to be from, I believe. And would you give us a quick summary of your personal story navigating these rocky waters? Because I know you didn't grow up in Tennessee, but I think you were even a preacher's kid, weren't you?
Yes, I grew up in southern Illinois, and my father was a pastor in a rural town. It was a great childhood. We learned a lot, and I started playing in church as a child, just playing piano and sometimes singing in the choir at funerals. And many, many musicians, if you read their fine print of their bios, did start in the church. And I'm talking about everybody from Aretha Franklin to Robert Glasper. There's all kinds of musicians out there that began in the church, just like me. And then when I moved to Pennsylvania, I was in high school and went on to college, our denominational college, and that's when I majored in music. And it was in the 70s, and we were, things are simpler then, and so I went straight into a performance career right out of college. Met some people in Nashville and made a record, and learned a lot from those folks. And I think when we met, John, I was back in the Pittsburgh area playing in a very experimental band, and that didn't last long.
Hey, I was going to say, that would put it mildly, an experimental band. You were pushing the edges, and you've always seemed to have a way to kind of mix music and the church and yet really cutting edge music styles. And in the midst of it, you were even playing it in a bar at a ski resort. Tell me the story behind how you got there.
Everybody in the band had worked in clubs in some form, and I did too. And although I explicitly was writing a lot of worship and confessional music, when it came to making a living, we found a way by playing top 40 and playing dance music. And I don't know any musician who doesn't do a variety of things. If you're in music for a living, most musicians do that.
But, Jim, in this, you really were kind of, I mean, you were living what the beginning times of that worship wars. Where you grew up in church, they didn't have the kind of music that you ended up doing. And what was it like kind of having the church where you believe kind of one thing and yet you were doing this other kind of music and some people were leaving and fighting? And how to give me just a little snapshot from your perspective about, say, the past 40 years of music in the church from a musician's perspective.
I don't know if you remember, there was a Billy Graham film called The Restless Ones, and it was a very typical Billy Graham formula for evangelistic movies. But in that movie, there was a group that sang contemporary music with a Christian message. And this was when I was in high school, probably, it could have been 1964 or something like that. And then when I went away to college, I met black people in my college. And I had not known any African Americans as a teenager, but when I got to college, I met African Americans who could move easily if the music was more like a beat. And in 1971, if you recall, Oh Happy Day became a national hit on the radio. And that song changed my life. I heard this song, Oh Happy Day, and it was just totally transformative for me, because that song was in the hymnal that I grew up with. Oh, happy day, that fixed my choice. So I was able to kind of segue into blues and gospel through the medium of black music.
But that didn't necessarily fit your church tradition. And I know for me as a pastor, one of the hardest things was to deal with, for me to deal with, was when people would turn music into a right wrong thing. So now you discovered, oh, this other style of music that your church wasn't playing. It, you know, what is it? Is it a right wrong thing? I mean, what makes music Christian?
Wow. Well, on that right wrong thing and getting hurt in the church, yes, there were people who said that my music was of the devil. And there were people, particularly here in the South, who were influenced by Bob Jones University. And there were people writing books about the demonic power of the backbeat and all these things. And so it was really the hippies getting saved and the whole Jesus movement that began to really change the mainstream church. And we began to see more and more diversity coming into the church through praise choruses and all that. I guess for me, my church background was quite a bit different. But my parents raised me to enjoy music. We were a musical family. And my father sang simple love songs and played ukulele while we were waiting for lunch. When I was a kid, he was playing these love songs. And he was a Calvinistic, conservative guy. But he knew how to enjoy music for its entertainment value. And I think that really, really influenced me.
Wow. So you didn't necessarily have to be in the position of a music director where a church was transitioning from the old style choirs and where the music really was mostly the organ. And I know, you know, where I grew up in downtown Pittsburgh, my family didn't go to church, but I actually would kind of sneak away to go to church on Sunday mornings at First Presbyterian Church. And it was as traditional as you can imagine. They had paid soloists, and I have no idea if they believed anything that church had to say. And they would sing stuff, and I used to just cut away, and I'd go down. I think it was McDonald's, and I'd get a you know, a breakfast sandwich and wait and to try to just sneak in as close to when the sermon started as I could, because I hated music. And yeah. that was one of those kind of churches. Can you imagine if anybody had tried to bring in a rock band into that church? I don't know what would have happened. Did you ever, you didn't have to go through that, huh?
Well, I did, because in college we had a band that we toured and played churches, and we did experience some of that pushback. And as, and again, this was in 1972, 73. We, many of the students in this band that we traveled with had long hair, and we were wearing bell bottoms, and people in the church were horrified. And I remember to this day the particular pastors who rolled with it. They knew that there was change coming, and they knew that it was that our hearts were in the right place. And they accepted us, and they exposed their congregations to something new, even though people were really scared by it. And later then, I worked with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, which was a campus-based ministry. And then on campuses, of course, you were not dealing with the organized church. You were dealing with the very fluid environment of academia, and students were inquiring and questioning and looking for answers. And they really welcomed a musician that would express things in a more modern style. So InterVarsity was a platform for me in my earliest days. And then later, the band that we had in the Pittsburgh area playing dance music, we were musicians. We had to do what we could do, and that's what we did. We learned to play a lot of Earth, Wind, and Fire and Stevie Wonder, and at that time, it was disco, Boz Scaggs, all that stuff. So it was during that time in my life, it was kind of a both and. There was the church over here, and there was secular music over here, and never the twain would meet. But in my church in Tennessee, where I've continued to worship today, we were going through a multicultural project of bringing black and white together to worship. And in that setting, black music had much more freedom, physical freedom, clapping, swaying, improvising. And so it gave me a place to grow and to develop as a church musician in an environment where modern music was welcome.
Okay, let me just get under that a little bit, okay? And for me, under that, and I'm going to translate this into the fact that I was a pastor for so many years, and so I'm going to translate it into how people would respond to sermons. And I would basically say, if I had to give the cynical kind of church hurts and point of view, is that people were looking for authenticity. They were looking to be touched emotionally, and they were looking for something to really be concrete. Don't go theoretical on me. Give me the three steps to happiness this week. Give me the two things I need to do to feel forgiven. And my temptation, and as with a philosophy and theological background, is I want to say, well, let's look at what's real. Okay, translate that into music. It seems to me, people, you might be, I'm trying to do one thing, but basically people are saying, hey, Jim, you didn't feel spiritual. What'd you do with that? I mean, really, people are looking to be touched. It's like, and I personally, you're my favorite Christian musician in my lifetime, but that's because I like your kind of music. What if I thought, man, I'm really a classical snob? How do you get that feeling in religion and music? How do you deal with that?
I can't help people who totally align their relationship to God with a particular song or a particular feeling that they need to get in order to feel like they've been close to God. That's a tough thing to overcome, because culture is all around us, and there are many, many different cultures. Even in the town in Pittsburgh that we lived in, there were multiple ecclesiastical cultures represented in that town. There were black folks, there were Orthodox people, there were Presbyterians, there were Reformed Presbyterians who were psalm singers, and they were all there in that same town. But for me, if I wanted to bring something into worship that was both contemporary and scriptural, I found this verse in Ephesians, "You who were once far away have been brought near by the blood of Christ. And when you take something from the scriptures and you put it into a setting like Paul McCartney would write or Eric Clapton would sing, you know, it's pretty hard for a person to say that's evil or that shouldn't come into the church. And that happened to friends of mine in our church when we brought gospel music into a setting in the early 70s. And the exhilarating sound, the sound of joy, the sound of the Word of God coming together with passion and excitement, it was pretty much irresistible.
Mm.
And for traditional people.
And so working in a church was just really a smooth ride for you. It really wasn't stressful at all, right?
We were just talking about musical style there.
Now we're going to you.
In a church where you have a variety of people worshiping together, when I was the music director there, we would explain to new members, we are a cross-cultural church. We're going to be emphasizing music that blends the cultures together. We will do hymns. There will be hymns. We do hymns. We will also do contemporary hymns. We will do music from the Black tradition. We'll do contemporary Black music. So we had about five different streams flowing together on Sunday morning. And some people that I've heard talk about cultural blending on Sunday have said, you're not really in a dynamic church unless you're uncomfortable about half the time. Uncomfortable about half the time. And why do you want to go to a church where you're uncomfortable? Because God wants us to come together and be one. How the heck can we do that with so much variety in the world? The way we do that is by submitting to each other. So there was there was sort of a philosophy there that we presented when we presented to new members, this is the kind of music we're going to do. And I remember one person saying, but Be Still My Soul is my favorite hymn. And, and you know, we would sing that maybe once a year, perhaps. But people in the church, I think many of them have decided that the church is for them and they own it and they pay tithe. And therefore, they are buying their preferences. But that's not really what Christ sent us to do in the church. He sent us to have the church be reaching out from our walls. And in our particular church, it was a struggle for me as a white man to be constantly learning and listening to and developing Black music. It was not easy. And it was painful. It was painful.
But I think I keep going to the sense of individuals oftentimes connect worship with a feeling. If it's really going to be worship, I'm going to feel a certain way. And I think that people tend to be out of touch with what feelings really are. And certainly I would argue that it's not very good theology to expect God to deliver to your feelings and to connect that to worship. I was never behind the piano or choosing songs. How do you connect that feeling, people wanting to be emotionally satisfied, and their sense of worship? What do you do with that?
Well, musical manipulation is not a new game. It is something that's been going on in the church since the 19th century. When famous evangelists would hire musicians to get people to come down the aisle and accept Christ. And there were hymns that were written in the heat of the moment for that very purpose. And the most famous one is called the 90 and 9, and it was improvised by Ira D. Sankey for Dwight L. Moody, because Moody said, play right now, and I want to see people coming down that aisle in tears. And so the use of music to elicit feelings really is not a new game for musicians. And that is the thing that is hard for musicians in the church, to try to capture a particular feeling with a song when you may not be feeling that yourself. Mm. You're up there leading the congregation and you're saying to them, let's sing this song now deeply from the heart. And you're looking at your watch and you're hearing the sound mix and there are other things on your mind. And you have to say to yourself, doggone it, I'm not worshiping right now. I'm going to have to worship some other time. Right now, I have to lead these people in worship. And believe me, every Sunday, all musicians who are planning worship services are selecting music with their congregation in mind to help their congregation speak to God together in the language of praise and worship, and sometimes in the language of lament, or the language of meditation, or commitment, or conviction of sin. There's all kinds of feelings that we're called upon as church musicians to elicit. So yeah, we have a long list of songs, and you almost always know that if you do this particular song, that people are going to react in a certain way. And I could give you examples, but the current example that everyone feels the same thing, in Christ alone my hope is found, and everybody's hands go up in the air and people are just worshiping and praising God and the money is tinkling in the plate and everything is right in the world.
You know, you know that the parallel, of course, as I switch over to the preacher in the pulpit, I've been amazed with multiple services how a pastor can tell a story and cry at the same place in four services in a row. And for a while that bothered me, until one man explained it to me that really was kind of a part of, he said, kind of a submission to allow himself to tell that story with as much passion and authenticity in all four services.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he saw it more as a submissive, humble thing to do, where from a distance I was ready to throw the stone and kind of say, oh, you know, like the cynics out there listening, saying, oh yeah, I know there's going to come a point in time in the service when the pastor can get a little weepy.
Yeah.
And people end up feeling manipulated when they see that, in the same way that a musician could do. But let me even just add this additional twist in there, because in music, just like in preaching as well, you get to the issue of kind of celebrity. And, you know, we're in certain churches, they have named musicians, and certainly many preachers, you know, have tons of books and their own business on the side just with their materials. But you had a point where you kind of had to choose between if you were going to be a musician in the church, or didn't you come across a few people who wanted to make you a superstar?
Well, yeah, when you're young and you have talent, there's usually a couple of encounters that you have with people who say, I could take you, and I could take you places that you can't even imagine. The first time that happened was when I went up to Nashville from Chattanooga, and I had an agent there offer me a contract, or, you know, kind of a, that he would develop my recording career and my marketing and the whole thing. And I wanted to do something different. I wanted to go into that experimental band that we had in Pittsburgh. So I declined his offer. And then when I got up to the experimental band in Pittsburgh, and I was in an Episcopal church one afternoon playing a gig there, and this guy came up and said, yeah, I developed Barbara Streisand, I developed Neil Diamond, and you're next. I mean, it was literally that obvious that he was hustling me. And he said, in no uncertain terms, he says, listen, man, I don't care if you like religious music. Just give me 5 years, and then you can go back to doing religious music, do whatever you want. Give me 5 years of your life. And it felt like I was talking
to the devil himself.
Like the devil, yeah, the devil and Daniel Webster. You know, he's striking this deal with me. Just give me 5 years. And then later, as we get into, when I got back into Tennessee and left Pittsburgh, and I became a label artist at the Benson Company for 5 years, and that company, they also made sweeping offers to me as I was coming on. And then after you didn't sell as much as they wanted, then they weren't answering the phone, and the production of your recordings was held up sometimes for a year if you were not really on the front burner of their lineup, so to speak. So it was very painful, even in the religious music industry, to go from being courted to being explained away. Mm. But in the church, you're right. There's a lot of personality driven church ministries. And there's certain musicians right now that are well known and whose music is commercially produced for worship, and they're just big stars. People hire them to come to conferences. They fill buildings every Sunday. They have record deals. Their choirs or their praise teams are recording. They are able to hire the musicians that they want. So there's stardom in the church today, a lot of it.
Hey, Paul, I'm going to want to bring you in here for a minute. I have a couple more questions to Jim, but I know you come from even a different side of the church, and I'm kind of eager to hear, what are you hearing here?
I'm hearing what I've experienced. I'm a lifelong Catholic, and there is no more traditional music than in the Catholic ceremonies. We go back to Gregorian chants. I mean, this isn't just back to John Wesley or songs after that. There's a tradition of church music, and some of it's beautiful and it's moving and it's inspirational to all of us. But it's old, and it just doesn't play very well in modern churches. Not if you're trying to attract anybody of us, you know, under the age of 90 to come to Mass. And so I lived through, I'm nodding, I lived through all that, the so-called folk Mass on Sunday, where they were allowed to have guitars and longer hair and play something there. And I
that
think
was after Vatican II?
Yes, after Vatican II, they opened up.
Yeah, it was a huge change. Catholic Church then.
Huge change. And well, I mean, I don't think any of you can realize how strange it was to be a Catholic prior to Vatican II. I do remember being a little boy and going to Mass in Latin, and the priest didn't face you. So you were just observing. You were off in the distance, and the priest is in this holy trance, you know, doing these mystical things, and, you know, I know all the controversies of Protestantism, you know, he's actually doing the hocus pocus, changing the bread into the body of Christ and all this stuff. But it felt very distant. And then Vatican II, the radical thing was that it could be in English or it could be in any local language, and the priest had to turn around and face you. Now it was a joint celebration. It wasn't just you observing a sacred person up on a mountain doing a ceremony here.
Yeah.
And so that change was dramatic. And with that came a revolution in music. Now, I'm kind of gone both ways. I like some traditional songs, but I like modern music tremendously. So I'm always torn. Play the old favorites versus playing something that really moves me and gets everybody singing. My wife, to this day, we still go to church. We're one of the handful left that still go to church every week. And when we go in there, she wants to hear the songs that she knows, that she can sing over and over and over again. And they're always experiencing, she's like, oh, that one, oh, poke. And she puts the book down with disgust. You know, why can't they just play, you know, whatever it is? So I get it. I think there is a real, to this day, and that was 30, 40 years ago that they brought in folk masses and modern music and other things into the Catholic Church, and it's still controversial. It still makes people walk out. It still makes people close the book and not sing. And yet, when it's done right, it can be phenomenal.
Well, I just think almost any tradition's going to have that story. Anybody listening to this who's left the church or even currently in probably has experienced a little bit of the other side. And
well, I'll go one further. You know, I think it's been a demise of the Catholic Church that they have kind of the, I mean, it's both the appeal of the Catholic Church and the demise of the Catholic Church that it's a rigid ritual that's pretty much unchanged for centuries, except now they've made these dramatic changes after Vatican II. But it's still the order of the Mass. I don't know when it was first established, but it's a pretty, and wherever you go in the world, it's the same Mass. You know, the gospel might be different when they preach, but there's some comfort in going through a similar ceremony over and over and over again, at least for some of us. And yet, the fact that they want to modernize it feels staid and irrelevant. And so the threat is always of the mega churches here in Orange County. My wife always says, we should go to one. I said, I'm not going to go to one because I'll like it. And then we'll never go back to the Catholic Church here. You know, I know why they go. It's, you know, come on, they put a show on. I'm not going there. They're going to seduce me. Yeah,
well, in the process of this show, we're going to convert Paul. But in the meantime, you know, we really should have a show, Paul, on liturgy. And I'm not going to get, you know, James down that route because that's a whole nother one. But I am going to, we've talked a lot about the past. And part of that's because I am an old curmudgeon and I admit it. And you probably are too, I think. But, you know, part of the pain in the church world and in this style thing we've talked about is churches have gotten to the place that they say, what are we doing? Where it really is a crisis because the younger generations are not going to church in the numbers.
No.
And they say, how do we change that? And executive kind of decisions are being made. Well, I'll tell you how to change that. If you want young people in your church, you better put them up front. In the same way, Jim, you were talking about, you know, how, you know, you had to deal with interracial issues. There were different people who came up front. So what's that feel like as a musician of all of a sudden? Have you ever known anybody who's kind of gotten replaced just because they're too old?
That is a very common move for pastors who are hired to revitalize a congregation. And one particular Methodist church in our town here, they got a new pastor, and the new pastor fired the band for their 9:30 service. Now, they had three services in the morning, and one, the very first one was 8 o'clock or something, then there's a 9:30, and then 11 o'clock, and each one had a slightly different style. So the 8 o'clock service had a black gospel band, and the 9:30 was a CCM, or contemporary Christian music band, and then the 11 o'clock was robes and organ. This is happening all the time in these churches. They're trying to accommodate different interests and different tastes. And the 9:30 band was all let go because they were gray hairs and they didn't have the right image. They're kind of paunchy and, you know, and stable. And so they fired the band and they hired the 6 p.m. band, which is the young guys, to come in and do the 9:30. They played the same darn songs. Same songs,
but probably not as well.
They had their spiky hair, and they had their skinny jeans, and they were... So that story does have an end, though, John. After a little while, the pastor starts hiring people back from the 9:30 band because they were just so good. They were just good players. They could play. They could segue from one key to another. They could play things sensitively and smoothly. I mean, they had learned. So the seasoned musicians were actually brought back in to play in that setting. But that's not the first time I've heard of that. I've heard of musicians being moved around, like companies move players around at Facebook or GM. They move people around to do certain jobs. And the musicians are no exception. They're treated the same way.
Well, Jim, there's so much that we could talk about. And I'm even going to go ask. I don't know how we're going to be able to hear it here that well, but... You know, when Paul signs us off, if just in case we can hear you, if you would go over and switch, not to that keyboard, but bang on that piano a little bit, because that's a little bit of heaven to me. But so what's the and here when it comes to church hurts and in music? Martin Luther once wrote, I would certainly like to praise music with all my heart as the excellent gift of God, which it is, and to commend it to everyone. But I'm so overwhelmed by the diversity and magnitude of its virtue and benefits that I can find neither beginning nor end or method for my discourse. For who can comprehend it all? I think we've seen today, if nothing else.
That's right.
That music can have a way of, and even how we can cause trouble with the best of things. We know God loves song. May we be more patient with those whose music tastes don't match our own and be very thankful for a creator who made us creative too. It's not just music.
it's music. For Church Hurts, this is John Bash, and it's worth a thought.
Because that does bring us to the close of another episode here of Church Hurts, and boy, like every time we say it, surely does leave us with a lot to think about. If you'd like to share your thoughts or connect with the guest, visit James Ward Music. That's J-A-M-E-S, jameswardmusic.com. You can hear all the different ideas he has on music. And if you want to connect with our host, Dr. John Bash, he's a shepherd with Standing Stone, a nonprofit ministry committed to caring for pastors and Christian leaders at risk of leaving the ministry prematurely. You can find out more about John and Standing Stone at standingstoneministry.org. So for all of us here who put this show on, yeah, church hurts. But what's the alternative? See you next time, right here on Orange County's only community radio station, octalkradio.net. There you go. Wow, you guys hit something.